Look, before I reveal to you the identity of my next guest, let me say this. I wish she and Bill Clinton were still running the world, because then it seemed a somewhat saner, safer place for all its problems. Yes, Madeleine Albright, born to be a capital P patriot, what was only ever in question, which only fate could determine, was which country she would stand for. At the age of 11, she, like millions of refugees before and after, sailed past the old Statue of Liberty into a new life in America. She and her folks had fled communism in Czechoslovakia, and there they were in the US looking for a new life. Well, let the record show that America was pretty good to Madeleine Albright, and she to it. In 1996, after what, by all accounts, was an already distinguished career, Bill Clinton gave her a call, asked her to become his Secretary of State, and let me check this, yes, the 64th in US history. It put her at the forefront of just about every major world issue that the world faced and still faces today. Look, over the years, beloved listeners, we've talked about Madeleine Albright on this show umpteen times in the context of, well, Bosnia, Rwanda, Somalia, NATO, the Middle East, Saddam Hussein, etc. But it's always been a discussion about her in the third person. So I'm delighted that we've got her in the first person. And she's got a new memoir called Madam Secretary, a particularly fascinating insight into the politics and personalities of diplomacy. Madeleine, thanks for your time.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Now, the highest-ranking woman in U.S. history, do you still hold that title? I guess you do.
I think I do, for the time being.
Yeah.
You never know, but at the moment I am the highest-ranking woman.
Hillary was on your side, wasn't she? But it was a job you couldn't openly lobby for.
Well, that's right. And Hillary was a very good friend, is a very good friend. But it, one of those things, you know very well that somebody is campaigning for it, but it's not kind of normal saying, I'd love this job and this is why I'm good. And so you have to be more subtle. But it definitely goes on.
And she heard, her advice to Bill was that only if you pick Madeleine would you get a person who shares your values, who's an eloquent defender of your foreign policy, and who will make every girl proud. I understand that Tom Oliphant said, however, in regard to the boys, that the boys are catatonic.
Well, they were a bit surprised because they actually had much more formal networks in terms of thinking that they, one of them, would get the job. And who would have ever thought that Madeleine, whom they all knew from various other parts of my life when I was a friend of their wife's or on some board or a lower-level staff on somebody's office where I actually made coffee occasionally. So the whole idea that that would happen surprised the boys, that's for sure.
Were you tormented by self-doubt the way, for example, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor had been?
Well, I think my book shows not tormented, but clearly there is something about, maybe it's just about women, who kind of always question whether we're doing the best possible job and wondering, you know, whether one day you could have done it differently and life would have turned out, a particular issue might have turned out in a different way. I think it's kind of characteristic, but I can't say I was tormented.
Let's talk about blokes for a minute, because you do some marvelous musings in the memoir about how men shape women's lives. I was particularly intrigued by the private dinner you had with Hillary Clinton and King Hussein's widow, Queen Noor, and you suddenly found yourself struck by the common ground you shared. Three women who had been, and I quote, deceived, deserted, or died by the men in their lives.
Yes, well, it was interesting because we were all actually gathered to talk about how we were going to write our books, and Hillary had obviously already written a book, It Takes a Village, and so she was the experienced person. But we didn't specifically talk about how the men in our lives had affected us, but you could tell because we were talking about what we were interested in doing now, how we had, in fact, determined what we were going to do, and how much we had in common as women who wanted to make a difference in whatever area we were working in.
Have you always found it easy to sort of buddy up with women?
I have. Men too, frankly. But I think that one of the things about the background that you describe is that I kept moving around as a child, and I always had to make friends very quickly, and so it's very easy for me to make friends, and I love to do that.
Is that good for a diplomat, to have this sort of social ease?
I think so. I think it helps actually ease some of the more difficult problems that you have to deal with, so that while, in fact, you are there defending your national interest as staunchly as you possibly can, and often get into pretty serious arguments, I think that it does help if you are able also to develop some kind of a good relationship.
You're a woman who enjoys symbolism. Warren Christopher, your immediate predecessor as Sec of State, was well known for his elegant necktie, and you had your pins and your brooches, spiders and snakes and monkeys and things. Tell us about that, the way you used a brooch to break the ice with Putin.
Well, it all started as an accident, because Saddam Hussein had called me a snake, and so I had a snake pin and I wore it. So that's how it all began. But the monkeys was, I had gone to see President Putin with President Clinton, and I had three monkeys on, which was hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. And when Putin asked me about it, I said it was a reminder to myself to speak to him about the policy in Chechnya, which was not particularly diplomatic, I must say.
But funny, then there was the pin you wore in the shape of a missile.
Well, that, yes, it was made for me by a friend of mine, and I was having talks with Igor Ivanov, the Russian foreign minister, and we were talking about the anti-ballistic missile treaty and national missile defense, and he looked at me. By then, I think the ministers knew to look at what I was wearing, and he said, "Are you wearing an interceptor rocket?" And I said, "Yes, and we know how to make them very small."
So you better negotiate.
Right.
Yeah. Let's get back to that sort of the three of you, Queen Noor, Hillary Clinton and yourself, discussing deception, desertion and death. You were the deserted one. Your husband left you, but you do say that if that hadn't happened to you, you would never have become Madam Secretary.
Well, it's a paradoxical situation. That's not to say that a married woman cannot become Secretary of State. But in my case, I was stunned when my husband told me he was leaving, and I wondered perhaps whether it had something to do with the fact that I was doing so many fascinating things and had been working at the White House, and I was willing to give all that up to save my marriage. But then when I couldn't and he left, I then kind of plunged headlong into many, many different activities and was able, because my children were grown up, to give them my full attention. And I think that that did in the end lead to being Secretary of State, because I had my credentials as far as having a PhD, but I then got very involved in democratic politics and in trying to assess what America's position in the world should be. So I had the time and I had the determination, and I don't think that would have happened if I'd stayed married.
Now, of course, the Albright name comes from husband Joe, who's a well-known journalist. You were born, Madeleine Korbel, in my favourite city, in Prague.
It is beautiful, isn't it?
Intolerably so. 2 years later, the Nazis occupy the place. Tell us what happened to the family.
Well, my father, as I said, was a Czechoslovak diplomat, and somehow they managed to get out, my parents and me, and we went to London, and we spent the Second World War in Great Britain, first in London during the Blitz, and then we moved out to the countryside, where, in fact, we still were in air raid shelters, and I lived under some kind of a table that was called a Morrison shelter, which was supposed to protect you if you actually, the house was bombed. So I did grow up in England and spoke very good British English at that stage. And then after the war, my father, who had been with the government in exile in London, returned to Czechoslovakia and within a few months was named as ambassador to Yugoslavia. And then the communists took over in Czechoslovakia and we came to the United States. So I am kind of the epitome of the immigrant to the United States who is paying back the country that helped me so much.
During the celebrations, the democracy celebrations in Czechoslovakia, you're in the palace with Václav Havel. I'm out in Wenceslas Square with the crowds singing and dancing.
Really? And great.
But he was very sweet to you, wasn't he? He suggested you might be a very good president. of...
Well, he's wonderful, and I have to tell you, if I might, we were just in Wenceslas Square now at a book signing, and Václav Havel walked in and he said, I haven't seen so many people here since the Velvet Revolution. I thought there was another revolution happening. So he's a great friend, and he has, in fact, welcomed me and made me always think that I was contributing somehow to the evolution of democracy in the country where I was born.
Was he being entirely whimsical when he suggested you'd make a good incumbent for Prague Castle?
Well, I thought he was being whimsical, but then he kind of kept repeating it, and then other people started repeating it, and I thought, I better put a stop to this, because I'm an American, and I really feel that, and I also feel, and if you've been there, I'm sure you know what I'm saying, is that I think the people who have lived through the terrible communist years and have gone through all this with them are the kind of people that should be president, not somebody who kind of parachutes in.
Well, let's talk about the job you'd parachuted into as Secretary of State. The extraordinary event wasn't simply getting the job. It was to learn from a newspaper article that three of your grandparents had died in Holocaust.
Well, it was extraordinary. I had no idea either about the fact of being of Jewish background or about my grandparents. And I must say, kind of in my head, like to divide this into two parts. I'm very fascinated by the fact of knowing about my Jewish heritage, and it just adds to what is already a fairly complicated and intriguing story. But to find out that my grandparents had died in the horrific way they did was a terrible shock, and I felt so sorry for my parents, who had lived with all this through their lives and had not told us. And I was particularly upset, not at criticisms of me for not knowing, or even those who thought I was lying, but I was really upset at the attacks on my parents, especially my father. So it was hard, and it is, as so many moments in life, it came at such a moment of euphoria when I'd just been named Secretary of State. So that great feeling was somewhat mitigated by the horror that I had found out about my grandparents.
Was your Jewish heritage used against you within the U.S. at all?
No, it wasn't, ever. I think the only thing that ever happened was that there seemed to be some people who wouldn't leave alone the point about lying, and since I hadn't lied, I didn't quite know how to deal with it, but never, no, it wasn't used against me.
Talking about extraordinary women you've known, tell me about your impressions of Anan Eshwari.
Oh, interesting. Well, I first met her under rather peculiar circumstances when I had just been named to be ambassador to the UN. And if you remember, one of the predecessors at the UN, Andrew Young, had actually been fired for talking to representatives of the PLO. And I was just so unsure about what to do, and was it appropriate for me to talk to anybody since I hadn't been confirmed yet. And we were both in a dress shop trying on clothes, and all of a sudden she walked in, and we both had on slips, and we started talking. I met her subsequently several times, and I think she is a brilliant spokeswoman for her cause, and a very smart person, and somebody that I have, though not always easy, had fascinating conversations with.
And clearly some respect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The reason I raise it is because she's just been awarded the Australian Peace Prize, not up there with the Nobel.
And it's, really? And it's, well, congratulations. Yeah.
Well, congratulations to her. She's often on the program, but it's caused the most appalling punch-up in this country. I can't begin to tell you. Anyway, let's not dwell on that. Let's talk about, we've talked about desertion. Let's talk about deception. Clinton and Lewinsky, he lied to you. He lied to you. Now, the Nobel Prize winner, Garcia Marquez, advised that when you wrote your memoirs, remember, do not be angry. Are you angry?
No, I'm not. I mean, it's interesting. I am sad about the whole Lewinsky affair, because I believe that President Clinton is one of the great presidents of the United States, and that he accomplished a great deal in foreign policy as well as domestic policy. And yet, for the time being, this seems to be a subject that is of huge interest to people still. And it didn't affect foreign policy making at all, or in fact my job. But It made me sad that this kind of a stupidity, in effect, has made people always wonder what was going on.
Look, I don't want to be a voyeur about it, but you do describe the most extraordinary White House meeting you ever attended, in that Clinton sort of apologized, but then he said that the reason he had done it was because he'd been in a rage for the past 4.5 years. And you interpret this meeting as a sort of Southern thing, quote unquote.
Well, it was a bizarre meeting because the cabinet was assembled not in the normal cabinet room, but in a room in the residence of the White House, and none of us quite knew what was going on. We knew that the president was going to apologize, but then what happened was that after a couple of us made some initial statements, I did, and the former Secretary of Health and Human Services, Donna Shalala, made a statement, and then some of the Southern members of our cabinet made it sound a little bit more like some kind of a religious meeting, and Brother Clinton, we forgive you, and then some other people talked about redemption. It was rather peculiar, but the whole thing was
peculiar.
Not a part
of your culture, was it, really?
Well, I mean, somebody, a Northerner, who did come up to me afterwards and said, "It was weird, Madeline, but it is kind of a Southern thing." So, but the whole thing was very difficult because I didn't think it was really appropriate for the cabinet to kind of act as confessor.
You make a marvelous point, or you record a marvelous moment. Someone suggested to the president that only the person with the highest personal standard should be president. And on that logic, said Clinton, Nixon should have been elected over JFK.
Well, that was one of the stranger parts of it, because that was Donna Shalala who made that suggestion. But the whole thing, I cannot, even as I wrote it, and it hasn't been described before, I thought, this is so bizarre. And then, of course, I got myself all mixed up by using the wrong sports analogy. So it was weird.
Yes, I avoid sporting analogies. I always get them wrong. I'm talking to Madeline K. Albright. What's the K for, Madeline?
My maiden name, Corbell.
Oh, of course. And she was the 64th Secretary of State in 1997, and the book is called Madam Secretary, a memoir. The thing that impressed me about the book, or one of the things that most impressed me about the book, is the hard yakka. Is that a term that Americans understand? The hard work that goes into top-level diplomacy. For example, when you talk about events like the Y River Summit, which brought Arafat and Netanyahu together, it's, what, 9 18-hour days?
Now, thanks for the interpretation. I wouldn't have had a clue what you were talking about. But I do. It is very, very hard work, and it's the kind of thing that you don't think about, is that there actually are nights that you do not sleep, and you eat too much, and it is just drudgery as you try to get through very detailed negotiations, and you can't give in to being sleepy. You just have to pursue it. And Y was very long, and Camp David was very long, and it's kind of marathon diplomacy.
A few years ago, I had a couple of long chats with Henry Kissinger, who, of course, was the notorious jet-propelled diplomat. And it reminded me of an observation by one of our most famous prime ministers, Robert Gordon Menzies, who insisted the only way to go to an overseas meeting was, first class on a P&O liner. That when you arrived there after a couple of weeks of deck courts, you were emotionally prepared. But you'd arrive at one of these meetings exhausted, surely, simply by the preparations for it.
Well, it's interesting what you can actually do when you have to, and that is that I kind of knew, well, first of all, I did actually have my own plane. That helps a lot. But I could sleep on command with the help of sleeping pills and then could wake up and be functional. The hard part is not so much for the negotiator, because you're talking all the time. It's your team there that is listening to it that has a tendency to start nodding.
Yes, I guess that's right. We were talking about informality, or your what is clearly a genuinely gregarious personality, and there's that marvellous story about you and Primakov at the 1998 ASEAN conference in Manila. Now, the wider world has had glimpses of what I'm about to describe and ask you to talk about, and that is these little performances top-level diplomats put on to sort of melt the ice or break it. Tell us about you and Primakov becoming star-crossed lovers.
Well, the lunatic part is that I actually, when I became secretary, I got a note from the State Department saying, you have to put on this performance. And I said, you've got to be kidding. And the first year that I went, I did a performance as Madonna, singing Don't Cry for Me, Aziani's. And then the following year, we worked out with Primakov that we would do our version of the West Side Story. So we called it the East-West Story. And I came into on the stage singing the most beautiful sound I ever heard, Yevgeny, Yevgeny. And he came in singing Madeleine Albright, Madeleine Albright. I just met a girl called Madeleine Albright. But I think you should actually ask Foreign Minister Alex Downer what it is that he did at the last
performance.
No, we
saw it. We saw that. We glimpsed it on the telly, and it was not a pretty sight. But
no, but he did sing when I was still there, I have a little bit of Madeleine in my hands.
You promise you were going to behave on this program?
Now I don't know, but that was too tempting, I have to tell you.
You're being naughty.
Please give my best to the foreign minister.
I promise I will. We're not exactly intimates, but when I next see him at an airport, I'll pass it on. Now, let's talk about the world now. You trace September 11 back to the 79 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and you talk about how the U.S. armed the Mujahideen, and how after the Soviets were driven out, the U.S. lost interest in the region, leaving behind, well, you know, thousands of militants. Are you arguing, in a sense, that the U.S. is partly responsible for the sad predicament in which it now finds itself?
Well, I'm basically saying that we need to pay attention to the unintended consequences of foreign policy decisions. And it all started out, I think, in a very legitimate way, which was that the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan, something actually that the Russians had been trying to do for 150 years, and the Tsars had never succeeded. It was a major crossing of kind of a red line in terms of the extension of Soviet power, and the United States, I believe, legitimately couldn't really push the Soviets back, but could indicate that this was unacceptable behavior and to punish them by putting in a set of sanctions. At that time, also, there were those within Afghanistan who were the so-called freedom fighters, and then were joined by additional people, the Mujahideen, and then ultimately even among them Osama bin Laden. So it isn't that the United States, put it down to the U.S. responsibility for that action, but more to this unintended consequence is that decisions in foreign policy are not always huge black and white decisions, but are incremental steps that then lead in a direction that ultimately you may wish you hadn't started. But that's not just true of the United States. It's just something that happens in foreign policy making that makes it necessary for policymakers to look ahead much more than I think we do.
Well, of course, unintended consequences happen in one's personal life as well. But I'm glad you've raised that issue, because it seems that already there are unintended consequences for the U.S. in Iraq.
I agree with that, and I think that is one of the big issues here now, that in fact, while there may have, and we can talk about this, some justification for this war, I thought that the timing was wrong and that I didn't understand the what next, and the fact that it didn't quite work out, I think, the way that the planners thought, has created, as far as I can see now, and today is another example of it because there are explosions there, a chaotic situation and a kind of magnet effect within the country on bringing various kinds of terrorists in there. All the people that dislike the U.S. or the U.K., and they're there now a little
bit. It's like a theme park for terrorism now, isn't it? There are
Right, and it's a little similar to what happened in Afghanistan, a vacuum created, which then draws in people who believe that they're fighting for a cause, and ultimately, the hardest part is, I mean, I do think they're terrorists, so I think that is the beginning of an unintended consequence.
I let the record show that you were deeply involved in trying to get Iran to liberalize when you were Secretary of State. In other words, you were not desperate for regime change in these troubled areas so much as attitude change.
Well, I wanted to figure out a way that we could have a dialogue and try to stop what we objected to within the Iranian situation, which was their support for the Hezbollah, a terrorist organization, and for trying to develop weapons of mass destruction and or acquire them, and not being supportive of the Middle East peace process. And so it is actions, I think, more than specificity of who is in charge.
Mm. You agreed with President Bush and his assertion that Saddam Hussein represented an urgent threat to the security of the world. With what we now know about all the half-truths.
Let me correct you on that. Can I correct you
please,
on that?
Please, I'd love to be corrected.
My position on this was that I agreed with the why of the war because I had said the same things about Saddam Hussein that President Bush had said, but I did not see the urgent threat. I, in fact, wondered why we had to do the war now, because I thought that we had him pretty much in a box because we were bombing in the no-fly zone and the sanctions, and I thought we should be concentrating much more in Afghanistan and fighting the terrorists. So, and I didn't understand what the plan was for after. Sorry, but I,
yeah,
I
no,
wanted
no,
to...
No, I phrased yeah. it incorrectly. I yeah. take your point entirely. Do you now have even more second thoughts about the war?
Yes, I do, because I think that some of the underpinnings of the rationale for the war are not happening. For instance, that everybody would welcome us with open arms, that there would not be this kind of a chaotic situation, but it would be relatively, I can't tell what is, relatively less difficult for the coalition forces to turn over the functioning of Iraq to the Iraqi government, and just general kind of lack of planning for security that I would have thought would have been better worked out. And for me, having been through a number of post-conflict situations, such as in Kosovo or Timor or various other places, I thought that it was essential that there be more of an international presence, not so much to do the military, but to do the political, civilian, economic, humanitarian part. So I would have liked to have seen more UN in there.
It's a view which is increasingly shared by your fellow Americans, isn't it?
Well, it seems to be. I think that people are very worried about the fact that we're in there by ourselves. And I think that the administration did something very important when they went to the United Nations and got this resolution 15-0. But from what I've been able to tell, it has not generated the kind of international support that was expected. And where I am now is that I think we all need to work on the future here, because we are where we are. We might not have liked how we got into the war or all the various motivations. But I think that we now have to deal with what you and I have been talking about, which is this chaotic situation and the attraction of Iraq to those who want to really destroy various parts of the system that we've all been operating within. So I think it's time to really see this as an international effort and not just an American one.
Well, your boss, President Clinton, and yourself were much more in tune or better at operating the UN. Is it possible for the current regime to extricate themselves from that depth of aggro and hostility?
It's hard to tell. I mean, I think that one of the things about the Bush administration, even though they act as if they're monolithic, there are people within it who disagree. And I think the fact that they went to the United Nations is one sign of progress in terms of understanding the value of multilateral organizations. There are people who will never like the United Nations and who give it the back of their hand, but I think that there seems to be sort of an increasing realization that we need help, and so I hope that those forces within the administration prevail.
I'm talking to Madeleine Albright, and I'm very happy that this is taking place on the occasion of her book, Madam Secretary, a memoir. On Islamic radicalism and the threat it poses, you say, have long said, that the US policy of both the Republican Democrat administrations has been awkward and ineffective. How might it become less awkward and more effective?
Well, it's always harder to kind of dig yourself out of a hole. And I think that we need to, first of all, understand that not all Islam is radical. And that, frankly, all three religions have been hijacked by people that have very extreme or fundamental views. And what is supposed to unite people about religion seems to be dividing them more and more. But I do think that the main thing we need to do is to learn to try to work so that the younger generations within Islamic countries have a better sense of who we, meaning all of us who are not Islamic, are about. And I think we also need to particularly, it's not something we can do ourselves from the outside, but to engage, and the terminology here is always difficult, the moderate Islamic peoples to help, so that you have countries. And then the other part, I think we need to tell people that not all Muslim people are Arabs. In fact, the largest population of Islamic peoples is near you in
That's
Indonesia.
That's right, just so, up north, yeah.
Right, and I think that we all need help in this together, but it's really hard, because what has happened now is that there are people that are... I didn't believe in the clash of civilizations theory. I believe it's more those who want to destroy civilization versus those who want to perpetuate it. But I think that we need to learn more and engage the moderate Muslims with us.
So when you say, and you've written this, we've been afraid to push for democracy, especially in Arab countries, you're by no means calling for endless regime change.
No. What I'm calling, first of all, I do think, and I did a great deal of traveling as Secretary of State, 1,038,000 miles, and I've
You're
been in...
You're kidding. What have you done with the frequent flyer points?
I wish. Don't I wish? No. But it was, as I said, it was a little bit more comfortable on a plane that said United States of America. So, but I think that I did, in my lifetime, I've been to 120 countries, and while this may sound naive, I truly do believe that... we're all the same, and that ultimately people want to make decisions about how they run their lives. And it might start at a low level in terms of, you know, deciding where you want your children to go to school or how you want to run the neighborhood, and then that pushes up. And so democracy cannot be imposed. It's an oxymoronic combination, but it can be brought from bottom up, and I think that's what I'm talking about in terms of democratization.
There's not much in your memoirs about our neck of the woods, or rather, not much about Australia. Yet, of course, here, our relationship with the US is the leading policy issue. Any advice for us? Should we be perhaps a more critical friend of the US?
Well, I know how very much the Bush administration appreciates the friendship of Prime Minister Howard and how the process has been working. I know how much I appreciated Australia's friendship, though we didn't always agree, I have to say. We had these various ministerials, and we did, in fact, discuss issues that we had some questions about, some of them primarily to do with trade, I think. But on the whole, I do see the strength of the Australian-American relationship, but in any relationship, you do some questioning, which usually should strengthen it. But I know how appreciative I was of Australia's friendship, so I'm the last one to question that.
Well, as we wind up our time together, let me ask you this. You've got a new career as an author, and I guess the book's selling like hotcakes. Does that mean you've put yourself out of the political dogfighting now? Will you, for example, engage in the next presidential election as a supporter of one or another of the Democrat candidates?
Well, I think I'd have to have a lobotomy not to be interested in the political life, but I have decided that it's at this stage, there are many of the Democratic candidates are very good friends of mine, and I figure that my best role at the moment is to respond when I'm called for advice and to talk a lot about how I see American foreign policy as appropriate in this day and age. And while it's very hard, I have to tell you, while I'm traveling abroad to be critical of our administration, I think that we're going down the wrong path and that the U.S. is not weakened by having friends and allies. On the contrary, that we are strengthened by it and that we are, for the foreseeable future, the dominant power. But that requires some self-control on our part and realizing that engagement through the United Nations or in bilateral relationships such as the one we have with Australia or through NATO, that strengthens us. So I speak out on that subject, and I thank you for your kind words about my book, and I feel that I've been given a gift that it's come out at this moment where people really are interested in what the U.S. role should be.
And I like the eagle brooch on the front cover photograph.
Thank you. I have it on brooches. Today, as a matter of fact.
It looks so. Egyptian to me.
Oh.
Okay.
Well, it's...
It's not...
It's not Egyptian. It's actually French.
Well, influenced by Napoleon's visit to Egypt,
something.
I think.
That may be.
Thank you, Madeleine Albright, Madam Secretary. And the publisher is, well, in Australia, it's Macmillan. A great read.